Morning.
Morning.
I'd like to call the Ag and Food Finance and Policy Division to order, and the clerk will note the roll. We do have a quorum, so we'll be able to get started today. And Representative Brand, would you like to move the minutes?
Yes, sir. Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion to approve the minutes from the last meeting on January 22nd.
All right. Are there any additions or corrections? They are the January 17th meeting minutes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Any additions or corrections? All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion approved. The minutes are approved. The dairy economics. We are excited, but not completely excited, because there's a reason we have a focus today on dairy, and that is because of the situation that we have throughout the state and actually throughout the nation with dairy and how it's being impacted. But last week we talked briefly about the federal farm bill and some changes made. We alluded to the fact that we would have a little bit deeper discussion about dairy and the impact of the federal farm bill, as well as just understanding dairy. We've got some new people here in the on the committee, and we may or may not be all as familiar as we could be with dairy in our state, so we wanted to make sure that we brought in people who are the experts, the people that work with dairy every single day from Minnesota Milk. So Lucas Shostrom is here. He's the executive director for the Minnesota Milk Producers Association, and we are going to really turn it over to you, Lucas, and welcome. Thank you for coming today.
Well, thank you, Chair Poppy and Vice Chair Brand and committee members. I'm going to first. I am executive director of Minnesota Milk, but I do get to play farmer on my farm from time to time, maybe once or twice a month. But I'm going to turn it over right away to our president, Dave Buck, who plays farmer every single day, that I don't steal him for stuff like this. So I'll turn it over to Dave for an introduction of himself.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Buck.
You, Lucas, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is David Buck. Currently, this is my third year serving Minnesota Milk as president. My family and I operate actually two dairy farms, one in Goodyear, that's our home farm, and a couple years ago we started a dairy by Lonsdale, or took over a dairy. I have two sons heavily involved. We milk about 500 cows at our home farm, and I guess one thing I'd like to impress upon the committee is how much dairy affects the economies of our local area. I paid bills yesterday. I wrote out 40 checks. I went back and looked. I've written out, including payroll and everything, I've written out 70 checks since January 1. We have a huge economic impact in rural Minnesota, greater Minnesota. I know for a fact that when we suffer, there's other people that suffer with us. So it's kind of tough right now in dairy country, but you know, we'll find some ways to get through it and look to the future.
Thank you, Mr. Buck. Appreciate you coming here today.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. So I have a presentation, and I'll do my best. Well, I will not fill all the time so that we have room for questions. However, feel free to ask questions to either President Buck or myself. Your earlier comments are something that I've heard a lot. Great to see you, but sorry under the circumstances. That's happened quite a bit the past few months. Me personally, I quit receiving calls from farmers when harvest picked up in about October. I think they're on to other things and planning their next year and next 5 years. And now I'm getting a lot of calls from bankers, feed dealers, other businessmen who are wondering what their future should look like. And so although I'd rather have different circumstances to talk about, I think we do have an opportunity in front of us, and I'd like to tell a story today about how that I think could come about. Also want to thank my representative, Paul Anderson of Starbuck, who serves our area well, and I'll begin the conversation on behalf of our 2,700 dairy farmers in the state. Some of those are goat, so the numbers are always a little misleading. We work for the cow milk farmers, but a lot of the things in the goat industry do overlap. And I promise you this won't be your traditional testimony, or maybe I should apologize, but I am extremely passionate about the dairy industry, and I want to skip kind of the facts and figures, and I'll intertwine them throughout. So today I want to talk to you about several issues, as you can see on the screen. Thanks to the chair and staff again for thinking of me. Also, I appreciate the concern raised by several of you last Tuesday at this hearing. Dairy farmers are smart and innovative people, but only today are we seeing risk management tools, tax climates, and admitting dairy's environmental benefits and partnerships on investment that can help dairy for the next half century. And I think with your help, the state of Minnesota can make that happen. For example, just 10 years ago, there were zero federal risk management tools for dairy farmers. And in the past 5 years, and especially in the past 6 months, we've now grown to three. So we're now at an industry that had a lot of risk, that has more risk management tools than it's ever had before. Just briefly on Minnesota milk, we began in 1977 as a group of farmers dumping their milk to protest low milk prices in northwest Minnesota. Their first headquarters were in Moorhead, and actually they were so far northwest, their original papers were signed in Cass County, North Dakota. So in 2000, they hired their first full-time staff, and you've seen us here a lot more ever since. Before then, it was mostly a farmer-run, no-staff organization. We aim to work to build a positive dairy climate in Minnesota, show that this is a great place to dairy, and of course enhance our brand and continue fiscal responsibility to our members. Our 14 directors that you see on the slide, I'll bring up, we have 11 distinct districts and then three at-large positions. Mr. Luneman, who you've heard before this committee before, comes from Clarissa. He's our former president and testified here many times, but I also bring him up because he serves as chairman of the Agri-Growth Council. And I just say that dairy farmers, alluding to what Dave said to earlier, not only do we financially contribute to Greater Minnesota, but we also, I believe, are a big part of the social fabric of Greater Minnesota. We actually have Pat is from Representative Poston's district, and we also have two representatives on our board from Representative Anderson's district and two from Representative Steve Green's district. And otherwise, our members are spread throughout the state as our directors. Quickly, I will have my face on the screen, but in a clockwise order, that's myself. Brittany is our program assistant. Shannon is our membership director. Maren Bozix, our contract economist, also holds full-time appointment at the University of Minnesota. Jenna Davis does events in education, and Mr. Darren Macbeth is sitting behind me, who's a contract lobbyist for us and several others, and you met him last Tuesday, as you might remember. Last slide on Minnesota milk, but we focus on three things that many trade associations do: policy, membership, and education and events. A policy is anything dealing with you or also with D.C., and in recent years, we've teamed up with the states of South Dakota, Iowa, and Nebraska's State Dairy Association and worked together on a lot of collaborative policy. Some of our current membership initiatives, we voluntarily, at no cost to them, have a mentorship program joint with Ridgewater College. So their senior class or their second-year class, we take about 15 to 20 of our progressive farmers, match them up with the second-year class of Ridgewater dairy students, and pair them up for a one-day job shadow that's now required at Ridgewater College. We're also very passionate and working hard on ag plastic recycling. We can talk about that another time because that's had a lot of fits and starts, but that's something we've worked with counties, MPCA, Department of Ag, and many others on, the Recycling Association of Minnesota as well. And finally, education and events, farm tours around the state and around the country, and fun events like our pontoon rides, which you can come to on Green Lake this summer. So look for the invitation to that. Before I move on, any questions about Minnesota milk or clarifications on that? All right, that's what I worried about, because from here on it's going to be heavy policy. So class one prices, class one skip. No, I'm just kidding. We're not going to cover this. I do have the slides at the end if you'd want to go into this. But I think what you need to know is there's four prices plus somatic cell count, which is quality in milk production. And all of this is based on supply and demand. And a lot of the reason we have our laws set up the way they do is because back in the 1920s, dairy farmers were delivering their product to the processor, then the processor wasn't paying them the full price. Because in a perishable product, once you've already dropped it off, it's pretty easy for the processor, if they are not a good business person, to turn around and say, That was not a very good quality milk product. I'll give you half price of what we agreed to, or maybe I'll give you nothing of what we agreed to. So as that happened time and time again, the state of Minnesota's dairy farmers really stepped up, and we're built on a cooperative system. And I think more than any other state, we also have private processors here, but more than any other state, I think the cooperative system is alive and well in Minnesota. And if I can recommend or maybe even require a meeting for the reading for the committee, I bought this book on Amazon a couple years ago for $2.87. So it's not a a large cost item, but this is meant to remember. This is the story of dairy in Minnesota up to 1947, Land O'Lakes' first 25 years. And while it talks about Land O'Lakes, it also talks about First District Association, which is headquartered in Litchfield. First District is the first district of Land O'Lakes originally, and they're intertwined in that way. However, it talks everything from Jean-Baptiste Faribault bringing cattle in 1820s to Minnesota, how we became the butter state because Wisconsin was already the cheese state, and we had 40,344 dairy cows in 1860. We've been a dairy state for a long time. At that time, Representative Lewick, we had one dairy cow in Aiken County. And then by 1945, we had 1.8 million cows in Minnesota. We now have 450,000 cows today. We have had many other livestock expand during that time. But if the question is, can Minnesota have more cows, I think the answer is easily yes. We can grow back to those numbers. It's really not out of the question, and I believe it's good for water quality. If we can use the fertilizer that's made here and produce crops with that instead of fertilizer imported from elsewhere, that will be a net benefit to our environment, net benefit to our water and air, and then net benefit to our local economies. As I said, our cooperative spirit's unlike any other state. So five of the top 50 cooperatives are headquartered here in Minnesota, with Land O'Lakes, AMPI in New Ulm, First District in Litchfield, Bond Guards also up in Perham, Plainview Milk Products, which recently merged with Hastings, and Dairy Farmers of America, owners of Kemp's, also have a large presence here. So again, I would just highly recommend that you read this book. I may be a little more geeky for me than for you, but I think as Agriculture Committee members, it would really help you understand how our dairy economy evolved in Minnesota. The book also talks about Dr. Hacker, and if you've been on the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota, there's Hacker Hall. And Dr. Hacker was an evangelist for the cooperative system, and I think it's the beauty of the private-public partnership we have in our state government. Dairy processor by training, or a dairy plant guy by training, comes to Minnesota, sees cooperatives works well, doesn't know how to do it himself, but takes that message and spreads it throughout the state. And that's kind of how Land O'Lakes was born and our many other cooperatives. So again, I'll stop there. I get no royalties or anything, but a shameless plug for that book. So rather than tell you about formulas, I'm going to intertwine my personal history and that of Minnesota. And I hope to make the case that now is the time to invest in dairy, as farmers are making generational decisions as to whether they continue or not. I've talked to Dave, I've talked to my family members, I've talked to many of our other board members, and there's been a lot of questions, especially in the last 12 months, of is this the time to invest, or is this the time to pull out forever? And very small changes here at the state level, and I think some of them coming out of this committee, could mean more dairy farms, or at least maintaining the current dairy farms on the land for the next generation. People are talking to their kids about whether they should come home and stay or not. And if those conversations are positive, that's a dairy farm that can generate a lot of things for the state of Minnesota, which I'll get to in a second. So I know I congratulate you all for holding office, and you've made it to St. Paul, but that's only step one in your life. And I think Representative Anderson can attest that the Stearns-Polk County border is where you should achieve. That first star in the bottom, that is where I grew up, in Representative Brand's district, just north of New Ulm, so you have some context. I came here to the University of Minnesota in St. Paul, and that second star is where I live now. Just for those of you who may not know the geography so well, I just wanted to point that out. So I loved growing up on the farm. My dad, brother, and grandpa, who are in that top right corner, still farm together every day, as seen there. But as Dave said, it's very tough right now. Over time, my parents grew internally. And over my first 18 years of life, we grew from 60 cows to 80 cows, which I think was pretty normal growth, unless you plan for an expansion. But much has changed. We have better. We got better at providing conditions to get cattle pregnant. We have new genetics that have come available and can give you a 90% chance of having a heifer, one of your future milk cows, instead of a 50-50 chance a generation ago or even 10 years ago. And our nutrition, genetics, welfare, and stockmanship, which is the art of handling cattle, continue to improve. One of the beautiful things that I really love about the dairy industry is, and it's true for others as well, but especially the dairy industry, is stress-free cows make more milk. And we've really gotten good in lots of different production systems at figuring out how to make stress-free cows, and those stress-free cows make more milk. So when I left home, I wanted to be the guy on the right. That's a veterinarian. I looked at all the MIAC schools to play football, but ultimately saw that the best path to the large veterinarian was here in St. Paul at the U. And most farms in the state have a veterinarian check their herd at least every 2 weeks, and so it sounded like a great way to keep working with animals and also work with farmers. Have any of you ever stepped in Smith Hall? May I ask for a show of hands, Madam Chair? Is that all right? Yes? Yes? Smith Hall, for those of you who've raised hands, as you know, is the chemistry hall. And I got to enter the chemistry hall twice, and that ended my veterinary career very early. And I met one of these two people the second time that I was in that chemistry hall. You don't have these slides because I didn't want them in the record for forever. But that's my wife on the left, Elise, and she also had trouble with chemistry the first time, kicking her out of the nutrition department and sending her life to butter and cheese. From there, life has been smooth as butter, and that's my wife's likeness, carved in butter, as one of the 12 finalists for Princess K of the Milky Way. She literally, at age 20, was already known as Cheese Elise at the time. That's what all the banners at the Princess finalists said. And I laughed at her at the time and thought that was a joke. And those of you who know the end of the story here know the joke's on me. So we graduated from the U. We were both commencement speakers in our class in 2008 and 2009 at the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences. And my first job was in Vermont. And so these are the places I've lived, and we'll get back to that in a second. So I want to talk about dairy in general. Moving to Vermont, for those of you who know, the dairy industry is not a big surprise. As you can see on the map, very thick with cows. Unfortunately, this map is from 2011 because our ag census is a little behind. It should have been done in the last year, but hopefully they're caught up soon. But you can see that Minnesota's dairy industry follows the Mississippi River as well as the I-29 corridor. This map would be even thicker today within that I-29 corridor. And each dot here represents 1,500 cows back in 2011. And I would say that 1,500 cows would be about 30 jobs. And it doesn't really matter how small your farm is or how big your farm is, but it's very difficult at about 50 or 60 cows to have less than one person there. And because it's livestock, those people have to live on or near the farm. So, again, when you look at these dots in greater Minnesota and greater every other state, there are 30 people working because of each one of those dots, and they've gotten thicker and thicker, especially on the west side of Minnesota, since this map was created. But the dairy industry, like every industry, continually changes. This is a heat map, so to speak, of dairy cows from 2001 to 2011. Green means additional dairy cow concentration. Red means dairy cow loss. As you can see, Minnesota has a couple areas of slight loss, but a few areas of dense growth. In fact, our cow numbers are pretty stable at 450,000, and milk production continues to climb as it does in neighboring Wisconsin. That red line in the middle, if you can see it maybe a little easier on your sheets or on the screen, represents the movement of the center of dairy cows in the U.S. by decade. So on the far left is 2010, where the center of the nation was, and on the far right is 1960, when these maps were first created. And that map is starting to turn around, or that line is starting to turn around and head back this way. And if I was going to place my money on anything, I would place that line's center of the future somewhere in the west portion of Minnesota, containing Iowa, northern Nebraska, and South Dakota. We have the rain, we have the crops, and if we can roll out the carpet with the regulatory climate, I believe we will be the future of dairy. And I also believe that internationally. I'll get to that a little bit later. Also on this map, you'd see a shrinking of California, Idaho, Washington, and Texas. Those places still have a few cows moving there, but the pace is slowing. Growth in places like Minnesota, South Dakota, and Iowa is, again, due to the three R's, rain, resources, and regulatory climate. You'd also see cows leaving New England and Pennsylvania. As I said before, we can fit 1 million more cows in Minnesota with little issue as long as we put them in the right places. Manure can serve as a great renewable resource to replace synthetic fertilizer, and alfalfa is a multi-year crop that improves water quality. So if we can provide that welcome mat, Minnesota will be the dairy choice in the United States and worldwide for the next half century. As I mentioned, my first job was in Vermont, so I'm going to talk about the three states I lived in because I have intimate knowledge, and I think it's just a good cross-section of past, current, and future. Vermont and New York were the original titans of the dairy industry. New York remains in the top five in many dairy categories, but in Vermont, the economic climate is quite difficult. More and more people are looking at land there for their houses as what was pasture or alfalfa land in the past. Vermont is number 17 in milk production and number 11 in dairy farms. I moved there to work for the National Holstein Association. This group registered or kind of third-party verified the parentage to add value to the genetics of about 10% of the farms in the U.S. Each breed has a registry, and while I was there, my wife worked at Grafton Village Cheese, sending goods to John Travolta, George H.W. Bush, and CEO of Disney Pixar. That's when I realized she might be onto something. So after 2 years in Vermont, my wife and I moved to Wisconsin. She found a job at a Farmstead Creamery, and I at Hordes Dairyman, which is that magazine pictured there. It's a nationwide dairy magazine that began in 1885 by W.D. Hord, who was governor of Wisconsin and built the program that built the place that built Hacker, who came here and built Hacker Hall. Little changes can mean big effects. Over time, Wisconsin's dairy-focused university and paved roads everywhere to make sure the milk trucks get through, as well as their state-run research, now national as well, bolstered the products being made in the state. This gave way to Professor Hacker, as I said, and Minnesota was lucky to receive him. And finally, Minnesota. We're holding our own for dairy farms and cows, and while we're not pleased that we have a 9.5% drop year over year in dairy farms, you can help us manage risk, write the tax code, invest in the future, and help us manage the environment. In addition to these numbers, as you can see there, the counties in the top 100 nationwide in milk production are Stearns, Stevens, Morrison, and Winona. We still follow the Mississippi River as well as the I-29 corridor. And our neighbors are North Dakota. They're number 35 in milk production and have just 80 farms. South Dakota is number 18 in milk production and has just 225 farms. And Iowa is number 12 in milk production and has 1,200 dairy farms. And again, I think these four, along with Nebraska, will be the place dairy farms go to in the future. When we moved back to Minnesota, I learned of an opportunity to go to grad school. This is the city of Morris on the left and the pastures on the right. I don't have this slide in there, but... in the 3 years while I was also working for a dairy magazine, I learned to complete my master's, and I could have gone on to get a PhD, but I chose not to and took this job instead. And I mention that because a small segment of the jobs in the dairy industry I've already mentioned. I skipped over milking technician, nutritionist, milk quality specialist, equipment dealer, banker, and many others. But I just wanted to mention that there's plenty of people with master's degrees and PhDs working in all aspects of the industry. So that's why I continue to self-promote here for the last time, I promise. So that brings me to the economic impact of the dairy industry in Minnesota. It may be hard to believe, but 1 in 30 jobs is directly or indirectly supported by our dairy industry. That totals a $9.44 billion impact, and borrowing from what my friend, Executive Director of Minnesota Pork, Dave Chrysler, said last week, that's like building 9 U.S. Bank stadiums every single year. So while pig farming is number one over dairy farming in the state, dairy farms are also often beef farms, crop farms, and many times cooperator owners of their processing. Money stays local due to the needs for high-quality silage feeds harvested with a large water content that cannot travel far. And like all livestock, owners and workers need to be there and tend to the feed and the animals every day. So that all means a $27 billion in products produced and sold, and this is a number that helps generate jobs and taxes both in greater Minnesota, but I also don't want us to forget about the metro, and I'll have maps in a little bit showing that. So while we didn't just move home for my $19,000 a year graduate school program, The bigger picture is that we followed my wife's dream of becoming a cheesemaker. We moved to the home farm in 2013 and built the cheese plant in 2014. From left, as you see, is my father-in-law, Jerry, who is cut out of the picture here. But we give farm tours every Friday and Saturday. Next is my wife and me at a cheese event. Then her mom and herself in our cheese cave, which is underneath our plant. And finally, my cute kids. But in addition to being cute, they have cheeses named after them, so that's why I could have them on the screen. On the left is Lucy of Little Lucy Brie, and on the right is Henry of Henry's Havarti. So our little farm, which I know a few of you have been to, spent $1,141,084 last year. I pulled this from QuickBooks yesterday, and they give me the password, and hopefully they're not mad at me. But we have about 200 cows. That's probably about the exact median Minnesota dairy farm today, give or take 10 cows. Doing some rough math quick, this isn't our year-end books, but this is rough math from what I could add up, and like Dave said, all to local providers. We paid just over $500,000 in feed, crops, straw, and nutrient management for our manure. $80,000 in payroll costs, and that doesn't count, especially this year doesn't count, my father-in-law and mother-in-law, and animal care of $75,000, including veterinary, bedding, milk quality, genetics, and hoof trimming. Next highest expenses would be debt service, insurance, repairs, and family living. With that, we take just 8.5% of our milk. So from those 200 cows, we take 8.5% of our milk, and that is used at Redhead Creamery, our family's cheese plant. That generated another $520,000 in expenses in 2018. So our two businesses combined were $1.6 million in expenses from two enterprises with 200 cows. And I'm a huge fan of wild rice, and I hope it's an industry that remains for some time. But as a comparison, at least the DNR website, and I found this out as we were reviewing grants for the Rapid Ag Response Fund a few weeks ago, the wild rice industry in Minnesota contributes $2 million of economic impact. So I just wanted to show many farms in our state are on par with some of our more renowned and well-loved industries.
Yes, we have a question here. Yep. Representative Lewitt.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. I would not pay attention to that DNR website because I can think of some individual wild rice producers that roll up several million dollars a year in expenses just like you do. So that's a real poor source to cite.
Noted, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. All right, you can continue, Mr. Schoester.
So on the screen now, you see three maps of the state of Minnesota produced by our economist, Dr. Bozick. He's at the Dairy Forum this week, otherwise he would have been here with us. But Maren put these graphs together during a 2015 report about milk processing capacity, which is now essentially full. Full processing capacity does two things. It keeps our milk plants full, limiting growth and new entrants, but it also lessens competition, meaning when milk plants have capacity, there's more demand for milk, and our prices could be higher. The first map on your left is our major dairy plants. They include, from top left, the Thief River Falls Dean Foods plant, which made fluid milk and many of the Dairy Queen ice cream treats, but closed in October. The reason for that is probably due to specific company needs and profitability rather than the entire dairy picture. But for the farms of northwest Minnesota, it has and will significantly increase hauling costs. From there, in orange that you can see on the screen, we have a string of cheese plants in Perham, Melrose, Painesville, Litchfield, Le Sueur, Faribault, Zumbrota, and Rochester. We make butter in New Ulm, and then fluid at three plants in the Twin Cities, Maplewood, Minneapolis, and Woodbury, as well as the Hastings Creamery plant, now part of Plainview Milk Products. And that's home to the Valley View milk that's sold right here on the Capitol grounds. We have yogurt, sour cream, and cottage cheese in Farmington, and then Kemp's milk and an ice cream plant in Rochester. And finally, non-fat dry milk plants in both Plainview and Preston. So the next map is secondary, and that word is pretty misleading, because for the past 15 years, plants have made as much, maybe, if not more, profit from their whey, a derivative of cheese making, than the making of cheese itself. Whey goes into baby formula, protein powder, of course, but also many foods, including candies, nutrition drinks, and energy bars. So the plants in white in the second map are makers of our primarily dry or dense protein liquid products, including cheese powder, like that produced in Albany is a lot of the cheese powder that goes on your Kraft mac and cheese, cut and wrap cheese, and other specialty products. So the secondary plants simply mean they aren't the first stop for the milk. It's not that they're lesser plants. They may be as large or may be generating even more economic value. And finally, the artisan cheese plants, like the one my wife is making cheese at today, although they're smaller in size, these specialty products can add value to a group of farms or single farms by making a branded product above commodity retail prices. But milk transport does not stop at our borders, and this is why we have repeatedly asked this body to match our neighboring state's milk truck weight laws. Milk trucks pick up all the milk from a farm at each stop and are only full from the last stop to the destination. As you can see, this often involves plants right outside our borders, especially as you can see the growth in the I-29 corridor and four plants within a county in South Dakota of being within Minnesota. In Wisconsin, 90% of the milk goes to cheese, while in Minnesota it is just under 70%. But don't think that just because it's packaged in Minnesota or Wisconsin that all the milk comes from one side of the border. In fact, much of the excess milk in Michigan makes its way to Wisconsin or even Minnesota, depending on what our plants require or desire. To show how today's economics are so different, on the screen are the monthly, year-over-year, from our Department of Agriculture exit rates for the state of Minnesota's dairy farms. In other words, compared to 12 months before, the percentage of dairy farms that exited. I've put in red and green the kind of different economic times of the past 10 years or so, and you can see the couple of downturns in red, with the biggest one being the last 3 years, with probably the best year ever in green, 2014. Typically, that number, that exit number, waves between 3 and 5%, and I would say these numbers are maybe a little higher since it includes seasonal dairies and also goats, which often takes seasonal approach and go on and off, and these are month, year-over-year numbers. So each spring and fall, there's some deviation. But I've highlighted the areas, and you can see that the only time dairy farm exits was previously above 5% was when we were in good times. So farmers were cashing out when they had cash to cash out with. So many farmers telling me 2014 was the best year in their life and were able to retire, but the red tape of the last 4 years shows dairy farmers to be very smart. They weren't exiting when everything was low, and very few exited in 2015, 2016, and 2017. But now I believe we're at a point with 3 years of poor prices that they can't hold any longer, and this is why our number is spiking. And I have not seen the January numbers, but it was December that peaked at 9.5%. So in today's situation, we've got lenders in Minnesota, and especially low dairy areas, choosing to exit out of the dairy portfolio entirely. There are literally farmers that do not have a bank right now, not because they couldn't cash flow, not because they couldn't pay their loans, but simply because the bank has exited from the dairy industry altogether.
Mr. Shostrom, yes. I have a question or comment. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I could have waited, but when you're on this subject, Mr. Shostrom, could you talk about this exit number a little bit deeper? Do you have any numbers or comment on the size of the farms leaving? I would assume it's more the smaller family-type farms, and to me that's the most concerning part of that statistic.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I would guess you're correct. We don't have any great numbers from the state of Minnesota on that, but I guess by what we know in the countryside, that's true. But I don't think at all it's limited to small farms. It's been extremely interesting. We've seen farms with 500 or 1,000 cows sell in a very quick manner. Everybody's at different spots and in different economic situations, but of course, since we have a larger percentage of smaller or less than 200 cow farms here, you should expect that we would have a larger number of under 200 cow farms exit. So yes, I believe you're correct, but the department didn't have numbers on that, to my knowledge.
Okay, Mr. Shostrom, would you just, so 0 to 200 would be the small, 200 well, to 500? Do you have a sense of how you delineate that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I try not to use those words. Visiting dairy farms in 44 states for my previous jobs, small here is tiny elsewhere, and big elsewhere is medium here, and so those are hard. But I guess I would say two things. The federal policy right now is significantly helping those with 5 million pounds of milk or less, and that equates about to 220 cows. So if you wanted to find them as small, you may, but that's kind of what the federal has gone for. We as Minnesota Milk believe that dairy farms are probably not really on equal ground until they can ship about a tanker load of milk a day, so about 9 to 12 million pounds, depends on kind of your production. So that's kind of what we look at it as the people who probably need help,
right.
The most help.
Thank you. All right.
Second, in today's situation, of course, you guys have heard and will hear again on Thursday the mental health issues, so I won't go more into that. But as I've told several of you and some of our federal legislators, sometimes just a little bit of thought and a little bit of concern, even when it's not money, even when it's just making things easier, sometimes that goes a long way to let dairy farmers and all farmers know that, hey, you're welcome here. So I just want to remind you of that. And finally, potential new and future farmers have been forced to work elsewhere when their family shuts down their operation for good. And I don't think members of this community, this committee, are too surprised to learn that when a farm closes, it's usually closed for forever. So these are three things that are happening a lot right now. And so the opportunities ahead, again, I don't think it's all doom and gloom. There's going to be parts of the country that are going to be losing cows and farms, but I think this is the place where dairy farming will be in the future. If I can share a quick story, Rabobank AgriFinance came to our farm. We have dinners on our farm, and they had all of their people from continents all over the world come who work in the dairy industry and analyze the dairy industry. And they sat around a table and were discussing the future. And as bad as dairy farmers in Minnesota or the U.S. are feeling, they said it's worse everywhere else. And this is about 6 months ago, but at that time in June, they said, the next 18 months aren't going to be good anywhere. But for the next 10 years after that, I would put my money on the United States. And again, if I can infer, I would put my money on the United States here in the upper Midwest. We reached 19% for 1 month in exports this year. And we're in competition with places like New Zealand, Ireland, and Europe. Europe's about two times the dairy industry that the U.S. is, and we're doing a good job growing into our competition. We're just learning how to export here in the U.S. I'd also like to mention that costs dramatically differ by farm size. So I'm about to show you some averages and talk about averages, but again, those are averages, and this is always the hard thing to do because a small farm, somebody with 50 cows may be competing at a level with numbers of 1,000 and vice versa. So we're taking the average. But the new farm bill, as I said before, really helps those under 250 cows. And that may mean that there's a lot more risk for those families with 250 to 1,500 cows. So Minnesota, however, can ensure all the farms have a leg up, and we have an opportunity to help stabilize our dairy industry. So this is probably the most economic of a slide I will provide you, but I just want to set the level as we talked about the economic impact all the way down to a cow level. What does a cow provide today? Well, if you look at the Farm Business Management numbers, which is a data set of about 400 farms each year, a cow generated in 2017, which is the latest numbers we have, and 2018 probably would not be that much different, almost $4,500 per cow. That is up from $3,900 in 2007 and $2,300 in 1997. The reason that's up is two reasons. It's partially due to milk price, but a lot more it's due to productivity. Our cows continue to be able to make more milk because our farmers continue to figure out how to give them stress-free lives. So on the profit side, obviously that's just revenue. On the profit side, what a great year looks like, as you can see on the right, upper right, in 2014 is an average of $1,226 per cow. That's kind of our high water mark. What a terrible year looks like is a negative $201 per cow. So if you look at that revenue and you put the expenses in, you can see as you extrapolate them out to 50 cows, 100 cows, or maybe even 500 cows, it's small differences make a big impact. So the last 3 years, on average, according to Farm Business Management numbers, a 50-cow farm would have netted about $3,500. That means a 50-cow farm would have worked the whole year and made about $3,500 per cow, $3,500 for all 50 cows, excuse me. Again, just simple math, a 100-cow farm would have netted about $7,100 working for the whole year. A 200-cow farm would have worked the whole year for $14,000, and a 500-cow farm would have worked for $35,000. And I don't think farmers, I see a question, I'm sorry. I don't think farmers are asking for much more, but a little more, and some of that's coming from the Farm Bill, will help a lot. Is there a question?
Yes. We have Representative Miller.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a real quick question. What's the profit for, you have a number for profit for 18, and what's it looking like for 19 right now?
Mr. Shostrom.
Dave, you want to provide that on a percentage basis or anything like that?
Mr. Bach.
I would say, and we're just, in fact, we're meeting with our farm business management person tomorrow to go over our books for 2018. And they will be, ours is going to be worse than 17. I think that's, I'm expecting to see that 18 is worse than 17.
Madam Chair, just conjecture, I don't want to hold you this, but do you expect a loss to come out of that this year? I mean, for 2018, do you expect a loss to come out of that in profit margins?
Mr. Buff.
I'm thinking it's going to be very close. You know, and every farm is different. And I think that's one thing many people don't realize. You have farms that are just getting started or farms that have been around a long time. And it, a lot depends on the debt and equity ratios that can force people out of business. And you also obviously have management differences, but from my perspective, so we started our own. I've been dairy farming my entire life, but in 91, we bought the farm we're on now. So that's, you know, our equity position there is a lot better than the farm we bought 3 years ago. That is probably the worst timing I've done in anything in my life is to do that 3 years ago. So I kind of have a unique perspective on what that means. And it's very, very difficult in our other farm to, I know that one will be negative this year. Right? I know that. We might be a little positive at home, but industry-wide, I'm thinking the farm business management numbers will probably be negative for 2018.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Mr. Buck, speaking of generalizations, you mentioned the 2018 would be poorer than 17, and I would agree with that. The reasons why, either a lower milk price or higher production cost. Can you comment on that relationship and what happened in 2018 compared to 17?
Mr. Buck.
Thank you. I would say it's and when times get tough, you really watch costs. Our costs were actually lower last year just because you're forced to have lower costs when your income goes down by a large amount. And I'm going to say it was down, I'll say $400 a cow due to milk prices. And the other thing that's affecting it, affecting dairy farmers, we also are in the beef business. And when our cows are done with their productive life, they become hamburger. And I just read this the other day. It, right now is the widest spread between, we call them cull cows that go to hamburger, and what the beef price is. So the prices are extremely low currently when people want to sell out. And that's, in my lifetime, I've obviously seen a lot of ups and downs. I don't ever remember farmers having to sell their cows and getting, relatively speaking, this low a price. That's the other thing that's weighing quite heavily on dairy farms. And also connected to beef industry is the price of bull calves. So, you know, if you get $50 for a bull calf now, 50, 75 maybe, depends. 3 years ago, you could get $200, $250. So it's not just the price of milk that affects us. So there's other things that contribute to it. And right now it's them other things are piling on to the low price of milk to really create a real difficult situation.
Hmm. Very sobering. Yes, Representative Cleburne.
Please forgive me for asking this question, Madam Chair. So when we're talking about the profits, when I look at these numbers from a business perspective, it begs the question, why would you be in the industry? So my question is, when you're looking at the profit numbers, are you looking at the profitability of the entire entity, which would also be removing the payments previously to workers and farmers, the owner-farmer, or do you take your own personal payment after the fact?
President Buck.
Most, every operation is different.
Okay.
But most, I think at Farm Business Management, they do allow, for example, in our family, we take a draw.
Okay.
Because you need money to live, whether or not your business is making money, you take a monthly draw to live on. So that gets factored in. I think it's different now, too, because than it was when we started, because most, and I have two sons involved, both of their wives work off the farm, just for some benefits and income, quite frankly. So that's changed from what it used to be. So you do have, hopefully they can live off of the spouse working off the farm when things get tough. But, you know, every situation is a little different, I guess. So it's, sorry if I didn't maybe answer that quite the way you wanted, but
no, Madam Chair.
Yes,
no, your answer made sense to me. I just want to thank you for your bluntness in answering the question. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Go
thank
ahead.
You, Madam Chair, and Representative Cleburne. I guess I'd also add your question, if I may. I believe Dave's right on. I mean, every situation is different. What's a family living expense versus a business expense when it's all intertwined, as we've talked before, as you know. But I think the other thing is with 2014, we did have a great year to at least catch up. Mm-hmm. And studies have shown that over time, I mean, we are a value-added business. Mm-hmm. So that means we should be adding value to our land and our crops, meaning we should have a higher return than crops alone, and also helping crops and their basis in the meantime. So dairy farmers do and have to think very long term, and so if you just hung on for 1 year, you'd be out. But we are breeding our cattle for a return that won't happen for 2 years, and well, probably a return that won't happen for 4 years, but you won't get a calf for 2 years. So you can't look just 1 or 2 years in advance. You have to look at least 4 or 5, and I think that's maybe not different with any other business, but it definitely, due to biology, it has to be a little different because you know that situation you're making today won't result in anything for 5 years. Hopefully that helps a little. Okay. Madam Chair, I'll continue unless there's other questions. The next slide is just a reminder. I'm sure many of you have seen a graph like this. This comes from American Farm Bureau, but it's just the percentage of the farm bill that goes to different things, and nutrition being the main component, and dairy would be a sliver of that crop insurance portion. And dairy has never been in the crop insurance portion before, but is in there as of this year. So the reason I was called here was to talk about the farm bill, and Madam Chair, staff, I'm now getting to that. So thank you for allowing me the lead-ups, because I think the story and the different situations are a very important part. So I wasn't trying to sidestep the question, but I've given you all the Farm Bill slides that we and the National Milk Producers Association have put together in the last parts of the packet. If you want the details, you want the numbers, and you want the text, it's there. Of course, with the government shutdown, we still have we're waiting for many answers in that, but I'm not trying to glaze over the answers, but by and large, I'm trying to put things in dollars per cow, because hopefully that's a little better for you. But for 2018, if this is dairy margin coverage. This is the new program that dairy farmers, especially those under 5 million pounds or about 250 cows, will have the opportunity to use. This is that program had it gone back 4 years. And in 2018, that would have made about $1.50 more per hundredweight per cow. That probably means nothing to most of you. Some of you, I know, probably know exactly what that is. But that's about $364 per cow. So for simple math, let's back it up a little. And let's say it was only a dollar more in 2018. And let's say some of the reasons this gets really complicated is because every single herd makes a different amount. We have a large spread in Minnesota. Some herds make 12,000 pounds per cow. Some herds make 32,000 pounds per cow. So you can't just take milk price and costs and know what the average is. But let's say the average production is 20,000 pounds, which is what it slightly is, and that program would have netted dairy farmers an extra dollar per 100 pounds. The important thing for you to know is this new program last year, in a very conservative manner, would have equaled $200 per cow per year on average. So for a 200 cow farm like mine with just over $1 million in expenses, that's about a $40,000 net benefit to our farm. For a 100 cow farm, again, half as much expenses, that would be a $20,000 benefit. And for a 50,000 cow farm, for a 50 cow farm, that would be a $10,000 benefit. So as you can see, it's a small change in the grand scheme of things, but the federal government has stepped up and agreed that we need risk management tools to ensure this. So going forward, farmers, I hope, will sign up for this insurance program, but it doesn't guarantee payment from the government. It doesn't guarantee money flowing. It only happens when the price is bad or the feed costs are too high or the margin in between is bad. But this is just to show kind of how bad the last 4 years have been. This program would have been operating quite a bit in 2015, 2016, and 2018. And then over the past 15 years, 2009 and 2012 really, really stand out, and along with our last 4 years, which just kind of climbed to each other. One of the big differences is a lot of our costs are different than they were just 10 years ago, whether it's health insurance or labor. Those, of course, as you all know, have spiked significantly, so some of these are a little misleading. But just to show how much this program would have helped those under 250 cows the past 15 years, this would have been the benefit that we would have seen. And if you remember that $1 on average would equal $40,000 for a 200 cow farm like mine, that's of course the difference between a full-time job and not.
We have a question. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. So if you have a 400 cow dairy, do you get credit for some reimbursement for the first 200 cows that you have and receive that benefit?
Madam Chair, Representative Lippert, that's right. So it's a cap at $5 million. If you look in the latter pages of your packet later on, you'll see that there's a higher priced insurance after the first 5 million pounds. But yes, every farm up to a certain number, it's going to be about 20 million pounds of milk. You wouldn't get the benefit at all anymore. But every farm up to that level, so all of our family farms in Minnesota would receive that first 5 million pounds of benefit.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay, you can continue.
And finally, to put things into charts, our exports are holding somewhat strong. And despite the tariffs on our number one market in Mexico and its cheese, our all milk price, which is that complicated formula I showed you earlier, and the income over feed costs look prone to rise. But I think the overall point is that prices are going to come back. And so my question for you and for you to ask yourselves is Minnesota going to be there to take advantage and supply the market? And we've got many co-ops, our big processors that I mentioned earlier, that export from here. But this is my friend Dave Lensmeyer from Milk Specialties Global, based in Eden Prairie. Again, almost 100% of his workforce lives within the suburbs or the metro area. And he was just named, or their company was just named, Exporter of the Year by the U.S. Dairy Export Council. So that's him with former secretary and now our president and CEO of U.S. DEC, or the U.S. Dairy Export Council, Tom Vilsack, an editor from Dairy Foods Magazine, and our former chairman of U.S. DEC, Paul Rovey, on the right. So we export cheese from here, we export big products, but we also export derivatives. And Milk Specialties Global participates big time in the whey market, putting branded products in the whey market and marketing that all over the world out of Eden Prairie. We can have more businesses like this because they need the products nearby, and they also need the people. And I think we all know Minnesota's workforce is ready to innovate and ready to keep doing good things. And I think dairy is a place that can do that. So I don't want to leave here today without mentioning tariffs and trade deals. Tariffs, as you may have heard, it's probably about a $1.5 billion effect on dairy in 2018. And so if you extrapolate that to a full year, it would be a $3 billion loss for the whole U.S. dairy industry in 2019. What does that mean? Well, to put it in perspective, people were provided about $29 per cow in relief payments through the market facilitation program or the relief payments that was provided, and we would estimate that it should have been about 10 times that for the real amount affected. So had it been $290 per cow, we would have been whole as dairy farmers due to the tariffs. We're really hopeful for the steel and aluminum tariffs to come off, at least our neighbors in Mexico and Canada. It's not going to shoot the prices up overnight, but you may see a 5 to 8% rise in dairy prices. Also, the U.S. Mexico Canada agreement. You may remember this time 2 years ago, we were dealing with about 10 farms in Minnesota losing their market due to ultra-filtered milk. A plant was lost their market to ship ultra-filtered milk to Canada, which is it can be a derivative of many processes, cheese or butter. But Canada changed rules, and that shipment stopped immediately, and that created a backlog, losing 70 farms markets in Wisconsin and 10 roughly farms markets in Minnesota. The USMCA, if signed and ratified, would reverse that, and we would be able to again ship ultra-filtered milk to wherever the market provides it, whether it's Canada or here, and also provides us limited access to Canada's dairy market. So it provides us about 3% access to Canada's dairy market. It limits their exports. Canada is a supply management country, but they've also been participating in exports. And typically, within WTO and other international agreements, if you have supply management, since you're kind of guaranteeing a price for your farmers, you don't get to participate in exports. However, they have been, and this agreement kind of puts it back to as we believe it should be. And most importantly, it maintains our structure with our number one market in Mexico. So, this chart's probably hard to see on your, yes.
Representative Anderson is going to just interrupt you for a minute.
Yes.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shostrom, talking about the tariff situation and such, it's affected agriculture in a lot of areas. I grow soybeans, and if the price is low and if I don't have bills to pay, I keep them in a bin. But milk and dairy is a perishable product, and if Mexico, for example, can't take as much cheese as they used to take, what happens to products like that?
Mr. Shostrom.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we have a large national stockpile. People think it's government cheese, but it's not. It's a large privately held national stockpile of cheese right now. And so it just stacks up and kind of hangs over the market, and that's one of the big things that's happening right now. It's also a relationship problem long term. We've got customers. We've had great relationships within Mexico, and they're finding new customers in other parts of the world. I understand the goals and the long-term effects of the tariffs. One benefit that the tariffs may have created is there was a lot of powder, whey powder, essentially protein, hanging over the market in Europe in a huge stockpile that their government had purchased, and that has gone away. It's probably partially due to tariffs and people finding new customers. So that might be a good thing short term, but long term, those Europeans may have just found new customers. So where that cheese is going to go when the markets open up, well, hopefully back to the same customers, but we don't know. But yes, to simply answer your question, Representative Anderson, there's a large stockpile of cheese right now.
All right, Mr. Shostrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a map, and I know it's hard to read, but this comes from Hordes Dairyman magazine. It's our mailbox milk prices, and to put it simply, the mailbox milk prices should be what you see in the mailbox. So all the expenses taken out that are at the plant, which includes hauling and then adding on your quality bonuses and other things. And Minnesota in September, and pretty traditionally, has one of the higher, and in this case, the highest outside of Florida, milk prices nationwide. And we're a good place to dairy. And this is despite our plants being full or nearly full with limited competition. We continue to have these high mailbox prices in the U.S. because we can be the landing pad for future dairy investments. With more processing capacity, more cows will follow. And so I don't want to pitch that we're in bad shape as a state on the processing side. We are full, but this shows that further investment here is not going to hurt our dairy farmers. It's going to help our dairy farmers. We're full right now, and we still maintain one of the highest milk prices in the country. So I'll touch on our current programs and kind of how they work. Currently, we have four programs that are under jurisdiction of this committee, at least four programs. There's some other small things. But livestock investment grants are a 90% dairy farmer or livestock farmer investment with a 10% state match. Those work very well when times are good, but I do see, especially in this year, it's going to be very difficult for dairy farmers to utilize these because they won't have the 90% or the equity to talk to their banker for that 90% to put up. However, it's a program that's worked extremely well and helped our farmers really reinvest for that next generation all around the state. The Minnesota Dairy Initiative Program, it had its funding cut a number of years ago. It was a $1 million program. Now it's about $640,000. But it helps seven full and part-time people around the state help dairy farmers put teams together to plan their next move. And that might be transitioning their farm to the next generation and just putting together the documents and the people to make those documents. That might be building a new barn or parlor or installing robots, whatever those farmers need to do. But those people I know work really hard trying to help some of the people move to their next step in the dairy industry. Dairy planning team grants are a very small line item. It's a $3,000 grant that's used very limited. They're often used in concert or ahead of the livestock investment grants, but most years, especially in the past 4 years, we don't have all of them used because people don't have anything to plan for the past 3 or 4 years. So they work really well when our dairy economy is humming, but right now we haven't been using them. And then on the regulatory side, I just want to mention that every single dairy farm in the state of Minnesota is inspected every 6 months, so 2 times a year. And I think a lot of people are surprised by that, but if you do not pass that inspection at a high enough number, you cannot keep milking cows. You will not be able to ship milk the next day. And on top of that is federal and interstate inspectors who might come every 3 to 5 years. So our dairies are heavily regulated in that regard already, and these programs work well, but I don't think address the current concerns. So finally, our suggestions for opportunities here in 2019. Dairy farmers, as I've mentioned throughout, provide a lot of environmental benefits to the state. And we would suggest that the state supports and encourages those environmental benefits that we're already adding to the economy through things like nutrient management, alfalfa, and other stewardship practices. Farmers have voluntarily taken on many of these practices on their own and or through government programs at the federal level, and Minnesota could help enhance those practices' uptake. Second, we've talked a lot about those federal insurance programs. This is a small investment with huge potential. There are farmers right now texting me and calling me asking, when is that insurance payment going to be due? Because I don't think I'm going to have enough cash. And again, the maximum number for that is just $7,500. So you think about our businesses, that's kind of the pins and needles that a lot of us are on, trying to figure out the borrowing and the investing for the future. So farms with 50 cows would need just $1,500, and farms with about 225 cows or larger at that $5 million level would be a $7,500 investment. I think if we can support these sorts of federal insurance purchases, the state of Minnesota will reap the benefits through the economic benefits that we saw earlier. One thing that we did not work for last year was Section 199A, the Domestic Production Activities Deduction. That is within the federal tax bill. And the reason for that was because of this thing called the grain glitch. When the tax bill was originally passed, it was essentially written, some would say on purpose, but most of us think by accident, to basically eliminate all federal taxes for basically all farmers. As long as you sold to a cooperative, whether it was grain or milk or something else, all of your federal taxes would have been eliminated. Well, they fixed that, what was known as the grain glitch, and in spring 2018, returned it to its original intention. It's supposed to be a deduction for cooperatives that are making products domestically. So when the first version of the tax bill that was passed through the body last year and then vetoed came through, you didn't see ag at the table talking about it because we didn't really know what that was going to look like. However, it aids all agriculture cooperatives, milk, sugar beets, livestock, and grain, and it's solely for cooperatives. So this is something we think would be really good to conform to, and of course, not necessarily through this committee, but something that would really help dairy farmers for the future. And finally, although we talked about it, I think to set us up for the next 50 years, enhance our livestock investment grants moving forward. I've heard from lots of you and also senators on the other side about this, and farmers really are able to plan and entice their children to reinvest in the next generation with these livestock investment grants. I think they've been great for farms, great for Minnesota, and with a 90% investment by the farmer, you're creating a lot of economic activity for those local equipment dealers and bankers and the farm itself. Also, if you ever want to talk about dairy stuff, we're happy to do that. But if you want to do it over ice cream, one of the best times to do that will be at our second ice cream social at the Capitol in the Vault Room on January 31st from 11 to 1. Representative Miller, we will not run out this year. So if you announce it on the House floor, we had 200 servings available, and I regret that those were gone in the first 45 minutes. This year we have 800 servings, so let's see us do our best. But would love to see you there. And our dairy day at the Capitol, which I'll be making appointments for soon, is on March 13th, and we'll have a legislative reception down the street at about 4 p.m. So love to answer any questions you have at this time. I've got a number of resources in the packet after that. But with that, I will pause, Madam Chair, for any questions that the committee might have.
Okay, I believe we do have some. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, thanks for that. Taking care of us with the ice cream. I mean, priorities, right? No, I'm just joking. So I've been intrigued as I've come to understand the industry. And it, as you know, in my district and just outside of it, we have a great deal of growth in the dairy industry. And I think that dairy is one of the key businesses to ensure a great future for rural Minnesota. There's some other ag-related industries, but this is certainly one of the keys. And one of the things I've been intrigued by is you always have production and processing, and the chicken and egg argument, I guess the milk and the cheese argument in this case. And I'm just curious if you can give us kind of an oversight of what we can maybe expect. I know that there is, I think I heard properly that there's new processing in South Dakota, which hurts because I wish that would have come here. But, you know, maybe you can address what we're looking at future of processing, how that relates to what you're talking about here, and maybe what some of the challenges are that you have here in the state of Minnesota when it comes to that dynamic.
Mr. Shostrom.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Miller. If Dr. Bozek was here, he could probably give you a perfect number, but I would estimate with the plans that I've heard about and have been talked about and as well as confirmed, there's going to need to be 100,000 more cows in the region to fill the plants that will be growing in just the next 4 or 5 years. And where will those cows go? You know, that's partially up to me and up to us. But there's when I talk to our co-ops in the state, the thing that's keeping them from expanding is often the net returns of the future, and that's based on risk. And so if they can see that the risks will be mitigated, they'll go forward, just like any business would. First District in Litchfield has been looking at an expansion for some time and is now looking to do a very large expansion by 2021. Lake Norden's plant, as you said, Representative Miller, is completing an expansion that's going to need 20 to 30,000 more cows. And AMPI in Painesville, as well as in Sanborn, Iowa, has completed some plans that also number in the tens of thousands of cows. So I believe we're at a point in our industry where a lot of our plants built 30 and 40 years ago are living out their useful life. And those aren't all here in Minnesota. Those are throughout the country. So those co-ops and those processors are going to be looking for places to start over, to start fresh, to make new products. innovation is growing in our industry, and our checkoff group, Midwest Dairy and Dairy Management Inc., our national checkoff that farmers invest in, do some of that work. But I think there's a real opportunity in the next 10 years for plants to be built and plants to be expanded onto. I don't have wonderful numbers for you, but I think, you know, that opportunity is definitely in the 100,000 cow range. And, you know, I mentioned before, we have 450,000 cows in Minnesota now, so that could be significant growth and added benefit. I just want to pause, Representative Miller, unless you have a follow-up, but Dave has served on a cooperative board, and I just, do you have anything else to add on that?
Mr. Buck.
Madam Chair, we sold milk to Hastings for 25 years, and the last fall we voted to merge with Plainview. We ran into some issues that, and Lucas referred to the Canadian issue, and we were directly affected by that. We voted to merge, but I think the cost. And we looked at, our plant is old, needs to be updated. There's no question about that. It's stainless steel must be the most expensive thing on earth, I think. I mean, it's unbelievable what it costs to build a plant to process milk. So that's an ongoing challenge. And when I look in strictly from my perspective, being in southeast Minnesota, a lot of this plant expansion is not in southeast Minnesota. So from my own selfish interest, I'd like to see, you know, more in our area. Any plant expansion will benefits everyone in dairy because milk gets put on wheels and it goes to wherever the plant is. So anything that helps plants grow helps dairy farmers. One thing, and we talk about the price of milk, 5 years ago, and what we call basis, it's the price of milk, the official price of milk and what we get paid. We've lost a dollar in basis, and that number really doesn't get reflected in any government numbers. And basically what it is how hungry the plants are for milk and the demand. And so we've lost a lot of premiums in that the last 5 years, and that's another... Another reason that this downturn seems worse than previous ones.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Solstrom. So I'm thinking throughout your presentation, I've been thinking about dairy farmer in my district. So I serve District 20B, Northfield, Lonsdale, Montgomery. And they have 400 cows, well-respected in the area for what they do. As we were talking about their situation, they're very concerned about staying in business over the next few years. They said to me, the message we get when prices are high is add more cows. The message we get when prices are low is add more cows. And I've heard this from multiple producers, heard that concern. It was interesting to me to hear the kind of the birth story of Minnesota Milk with producers banding together to dump milk to protect their place within the system, a concern about people in the system and not just production. So I'm interested to hear what you say to producers who have that concern, what your thoughts are to protect the place of the small dairy producer, which is also important for small communities as well. So that's the start of my questions.
Mr. Shostrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Lippert, I would guess I know exactly who you're talking about, and they're a great family, and they have struggled figuring out what the future holds. You know, we get this question quite a bit, and the fact of the matter is that we're in a commodity market, and in a commodity market, most of us are in a commodity market. In a commodity market, the milk should be worth less every year on average. I mean, there'll be spikes and there'll be falls, but the milk should be worth less every year than it was the year before, unless we can increase demand to a point that it's more demanded than supply allows. Of course, it's economics. I think the opportunity we have, I shared the Rabobank story before, especially in the next 10 years, and who knows what the future holds after that, but the opportunity we have in the export market is very bright. We went from about 3 to 6% exports in just 2003 to about 18 to 19% exports now. You look at some of our other industries, pork and soybeans, for example, you know, they're exporting closer to 40% of their crop or of their produce. So I think we have a domestic opportunity here to make more products. And I think we have an export opportunity to find the markets to go there. And then what I was getting at before with the commodity prices, we have an opportunity to value add. And we've done some of that. I know the plant where my family ships milk, Bondgaards. I believe they add value, at least with their internal numbers. They believe they add value to about 45% of their milk right now. And they have a goal of getting to 90 or 95% in the next 5 to 10 years. And I would guess our other cooperatives and other processors are thinking of doing the same thing. The commodity market's always going to be there. There's definitions and things that the commodity market's very good for. But I know our co-ops are trying to add value. And with our plant capacity full and our co-ops and processors being a lot more mindful of who they take in, when they take them in, and what the demand looks like on the other side, I think we have a real opportunity for an entire industry to become value-added. And it's going to be people like the person you're talking about, Representative Lippert, one of our leaders in the industry, to push their co-ops or push their processors to get us there, and it's my job just as much as well. But I think there's an opportunity, and I think we're ready for it. It's going to take time, but I don't think we need to always be sending that message, and it's going to be up to those processing our milk probably to send that message back as to what they want their producers to do. So I hope that answered your question, but again, I think we have opportunity to get off the commodity market and be more value-added as a state in general. Mm-hmm. There's going to be people who participate and compete on the commodity market forever, but for everybody else, I think there's an opportunity to be more methodical and value-added.
Madam Chair, thank you. So it sounds like you see value-added pieces as a path forward for smaller, mid-sized dairies. That's helpful. Another question I have is just as you imagine the future for dairy and development along the western part of the state and the border, what do you anticipate those farms will look like as far as number of cows? Related to that, so I'm imagining you're expecting those to be very, very large dairies, or the larger sized dairies. And then also, and I just want to check and see if that's what you expect. And the other would be, where do you expect the investment coming from to capitalize those dairies, to start them? From within our current dairy industry now in Minnesota, or across the country, you know, large investors who have that capital want to invest in dairy. Will that be kind of homegrown investment or a mix of the two?
Mr. Shostrom.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Lippert, to your first question, the size of the dairies in the future, the trend hasn't slowed on dairies growing larger, and farmers and investors of all types look at the economics and make the best choices they can going forward, of course. And so I think what we've seen in the I-29 corridor in Minnesota and South Dakota, until that model is proven that it won't work, I think people will continue doing what they've done before. But while we might see growth there, I think one of the reasons we see growth there is because there's not cows there right now. I mean, I think that's what the untold side of the story. One of the reasons there's this huge amount of growth in a place like the I-29 corridor is it probably could have happened 40 or 50 years ago. There just weren't the plants available to fill. And so we've got places like Otter Tail County and north of there where I think there will be more dairy farms as well. They'll be very different looking. There may be places probably just south of your district, for example, where there'd be room for more livestock, very, very different looking than that. So each geography is going to dictate, I believe, what dairy farms look like. But, of course, the trend line is adding cows. So that's the first question, and I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't tell you. One of these models may eventually fail, the current models, whether it's a farm like mine or a farm like any other. So I think we as a state should be open to as many models as we can be. Mm-hmm. The second one on investment, I think I don't know too many dairy farmers or too many people who work as hard as dairy farmers, and that's not to put down any other businesses. Lots of people work hard. But the tie to your land and the tie to your animals, I think, is unique. And so, therefore, I think while the investment, per se, or lending may come from outside, I think, by and large, the profits and the undertaking will continue to be by people who care and have the will to be on a dairy farm. So I see options opening in that. There's been talk about ETFs and other kind of fiscal funds being able to maybe buy up 49% of lots of small and mid-sized dairies, if you want to call them that, around the country. I've seen that listed in reports, but that hasn't happened. But I think if that gets more people farming and that flexibility is available, we should take it as long as we can continue to keep the profits here, as I think they will be.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Representative Luwak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that I'm curious about, particularly with the potential for new plants or expanded plants, what type of transportation issues are we really dealing with? Because obviously milk is a lot more perishable than timber, but in my part of the state, boy, you put down a mill for timber, and that's a little slower moving resource, but you count the trees out there and you add up the miles, and it's absolutely some things are just flat economically not possible because of that transportation link. And how does that play into this potential lots of new cows coming? I mean, can you already draw lines and say they're not going to get there because unless there's a plant, new plant shows up? We deal with that in the timber industry all the time.
Mr. Shostrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Lewick, so milk, as you may or may not know, is 87% water. So transportation is an extremely big deal. The faster we get that converted into cheese, which has a much lower moisture content, the easier it is to ship and less costly. So your question's right on. Cows are going to be near the plants, but as far as drawing a circle or something like that, I think we have a lot of leeway. We do ship milk occasionally from Minnesota to Florida. It can get there in about 20 hours, and it can be on the shelf 48 hours later. So it depends on the economics. But as I mentioned before, people in northwest Minnesota have seen their costs rise significantly when the Thief River Falls plant closed down. And we're going to a true cost of hauling model. That hasn't happened in Minnesota or Wisconsin for ever. And now people are seeing on their milk check, it was always embedded in their milk check, but they're seeing in their milk check the true price. And I don't know, I've heard it's usually about $1 a hundred. Is that?
Mr. Buck.
Yeah. And I'm just going to, some numbers from our co-op was 70 cents is what it costs to get milk from the farm to the plant. And we are a fairly local group of farmers. So it's, a dollar is not out of reason.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Lewick, I think, again, to put it in perspective, our normal pay price might be somewhere between $15 and $18, so $1 out of $15 or $1 out of $18 going to hauling can mean a lot. So keeping the milk where the feed is and the plant nearby is important, but, again, as we've talked as our policy, people that get up to a tanker load of milk, or once you can put together a tanker load of milk in a small space, maybe it's a cluster of farms with 200 cows, you've really cut down your transportation costs quite a bit. So while it's a concern, I wouldn't say it's the only factor or a main factor of where a plant's going to go is hauling, but it is important.
Right.
Just a quick comment. I appreciate that. I in my part of the state, we went from cream cans and milk trucks running in all directions to bulk trucks picking up from the dairies to a few dairies were able to hang on, and they'd come in a couple times a week because they could support the storage requirements to keep milk overnight, and they're gone. And that had to do with the distance and the ability. They had to get significantly bigger or there was no way to survive. So it is really important where those plants sit down. Because it can shut off an entire part of the state that may have the other resources that can certainly support dairy.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. And to either one of the testifiers, just very recently, There was a business that was going to be located in the city of Laverne, and because they could not get a timely permit by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, they just jumped the border and they're able to build it in South Dakota. Do you see those same challenges in the dairy industry when it comes to permitting new sites, whether it's a farm or processing?
Mr. Buck.
I'll make a comment from the processor side first. I served on the board of directors of the Hastings Co-op Creamery, and we were looking at doing something. And located in Dakota County. So we were under the auspices of the Met Council, and it was going to cost us $1 million to get a permit. And for our size, for an $8 million project, that seemed ridiculous, actually. We could have went across the river and not had to pay that. We could have moved 20 miles south to Goodyear County, Cannon Falls, and not had to pay that. So from a processor perspective, that was very challenging. And we weren't going to change the amount of water we use. In fact, we were hoping we'd become more efficient because it'd be a new plant, but we're still going to have to pay that $1 million, so that really discouraged us. From a dairy farmer perspective, you know, there's always challenges when you want a permit. And there's been a couple of them in southeast Minnesota, I think, that have now been approved, and I think rightfully so. One thing with dairy you got to remember is, and I truly believe this, we are sustainable. We take the feed from the land. We feed the cows. The cows produce milk for us and produce manure for the land. It's as sustainable of an industry as there is. And if you have dairy, you're going to have hay. Hay is good for the land in different ways. So to your question about regulation, you know, it's always a challenge. And we want clean water, too. We're no different than anybody else. But sometimes regulation is not based on common sense sometimes. And I think that's really, in my the last 10 years, my perspective is it has improved, and I would hope it continues to improve, the working relationship between the regulators and the farmers. And I, you know, we have a change in administration now, and I look forward to that continuing, I guess.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
And Madam Chair, thank you. And a follow-up, I really appreciated the testimony as it pertains to why dairy should be located here. And it appears that we're seeing a mass exodus of cows out of California and some of the western states coming back to the Midwest. A few years ago, we saw a chart where the dairy was locating almost as a horseshoe around the state of Minnesota. We're trying to figure out why that is. Do you have any idea on why that's taking place?
Mr. Shostrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, I think going back to what I said earlier and also with what President Buck's comments just were, I think some of it's perception. I think we're perceived as a difficult regulatory state. I don't think all of that is true. And I think there's little things we can do, and as Dave alluded to, I would thank Commissioner Stein, or former Commissioner Stein at the PCA, for the work he did in making us customer service focused. And now I think if we have the rules changed to line up with that customer service focus on the service side, to match the rules and regulations on the actual law, what you need to pay, We're gonna be a welcoming mat for dairies and for plants as well. To your earlier question, I think little differences. It's all about risk management. Little differences mean a big difference to any business. I know in my business it's the same thing. And those of you who are business people around the table, I'm sure would agree. But it's a small a difference, I think, that makes that impact. Is it regulation in Minnesota that's scaring those people away? I don't know. But I think there's small things we can do to work on that to welcome them here.
Thank you. We're actually nearly at our time. So to conclude this, Representative Anderson, did you have a final comment or question?
Well, just a quick comment, Madam Chair. As I recall, I reading about the processing plant in Painesville that didn't expand as large as they could have because of regulations and such. It wasn't worth the risk or the investment. So I think we do need to work on becoming more business-friendly in the state, regulation-wise, to encourage those plants to locate here in the state, as Representative Lewick mentioned, close to the cows to keep the transportation costs down. So we all need to work on that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And thank you very much to President Bach and to the Executive Director, Lucas Sjostrom, for coming today for a very sobering but educational hour and a half presentation. That was well done and very much appreciated. I think we all have a further appreciation for the work that you do and the needs and the concerns that you have shared with us today. So thank you very much. And with that, meeting adjourned.